Now we turn to Laurie Mercier, who continues our coverage of the Occupy movement by talking with Desiree Heligers about how the Occupy movement gives voice to the homeless and the unique challenges facing women in these troubled times. Laurie?
Thanks, Joe. Over the past few months, KBOO and the Old Mole Variety Hour have been reporting and analyzing the Occupy Wall Street protests, which have echoed the real permanent occupation protests against inequality in this nation by the homeless. Homelessness is a constant reminder that the United States has another 1%, the people who are economically the worst off in the nation. But unlike the richest 1% of Americans who had their fortunes protected by government bailouts and other forms of welfare, the poorest Americans have not only been experiencing dramatic cuts to social services, but they are often demonized by politicians and the media as unproductive and drains on a struggling state and local economy. Occupy movement protesters have been in tension, education and collaboration with the many unhoused in American cities. And I even wonder if the specter of potential collaborations and demands motivated city officials to evict the Occupy movement. Although Portland's Mayor Sam Adams justified the Portland evictions in order to move homelessness off the streets and into services, in Portland and other cities, there are at least two homeless people for every open bed in the shelter system, according to the most recent data from the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, which also notes that since 2007 and the recent economic crisis, job losses and foreclosures helped push more than 30% more people into homeless shelters. Of course, those are some of the same problems that have inspired people to protest and occupy the center squares of cities across the country. Well, absent in this media coverage are the voices of the homeless, which our guest, Desiree Heligers, an associate professor of English at Washington State University, Vancouver, and co-director of its Center for Social and Environmental Justice, has sought to help document in her new book, No Room of Her Own, Women's Stories of Homelessness, Life, Death, and Resistance. Welcome to KBOO, Desiree.
Thanks, Lori.
Tell us how you came to work on this project to feature the testimonies of homeless women.
Well, the book has its genesis in the early 1980s, and it emerged out of a year that I spent living and working at a shelter for women and families in Seattle. And I had sort of minimal duties in my job there and mostly hung out and listened for hours to homeless women talk about their lives and experiences, and went on from there to another 2 years working at the Lutheran Compass Center Women's Program at the edge of Pioneer Square in downtown Seattle, and spent a lot of time working swing shifts and graveyard shifts and really listening to women speak about their own experiences and about their own sort of work lives, from, you know, working as construction workers, CNAs, RNAs, waitresses, writers, prostitutes, dancers, you know, just a full range of life experiences and work experiences. And I was really struck by kind of the disparity between the very kind of abbreviated, somewhat clinical notes I was drafting at the end of every shift and the reality and sort of complexity of the stories that the women told about their own lives. And so I wanted to kind of explore oral history in this book as a vehicle for trying to convey some of that complex life experience and the sort of really kind of, you know, range of insights, from political insights to philosophical and theological perspective, that women brought to bear on their own lives and also on civil society in the U.S. more broadly.
So what came out in some of these stories that homeless women themselves told versus what was often reported in the media or by social service agencies?
Well, I think just first of all, homeless people's ability to reflect on political culture in the U.S. and their own insights into the, you know, nature and roots of inequality. So one of the things that emerged pretty early on in my interviews with women was a kind of critical perspective on military spending, for example, and also a number of the women themselves came from military families. And that, while it's not a thread that I take up in great depth in the book, I think it raises a lot of questions about, you know, we know that about a third of homeless men on the streets are veterans. But I think one of the things that hasn't been examined in depth is kind of the intergenerational effects of military service on families as a whole. So it seemed to me that for a number of the women, you know, they were experiencing kind of the intergenerational fallout of, for example, untreated PTSD and other, certainly other kind of aspects of military culture, I think, that impacted their lives. And one of the women that I interviewed for the book, Anitra Freeman, who is really one of the most visible and engaged formerly homeless activists in Seattle working on homelessness, is herself an Air Force veteran. And in my interview with her, she took up the issue of how her father's untreated PTSD from his service during the Korean War had really impacted her family's life. So I kind of started out focusing in on just asking the women to speak about their own lives in whatever terms they wanted to speak about. What did they want? What about their lives did they want the public to hear? And I did that specifically because I didn't want to kind of categorize people as somehow essentially homeless, because, you know, for homeless people, that may not be the absolutely defining moment in their existence. And I think that the discourse about homelessness in this country really labels and essentializes you as homeless, that it becomes a sort of, you know, essential way of kind of marginalizing and discrediting people's experience.
Because they can't be like us. They have to be otherized in order for us to better ignore and step over them.
Right. I think that's a really good way of framing it. And so, you know, that's, I think, from the earliest interviews I did, though, one of the things that emerged really was the way in which the women were engaged in kind of networks of mutual support and, you know, countless hours of unpaid social services and mentoring each other about, you know, how to access different services and sharing resources. I mean, that was something that I experienced a lot in the time that I spent in community with homeless people when I was living and working at the shelter in Seattle. And so it wasn't surprising to me that that theme emerged. But I think out of that, then I got interested in exploring some of the movements, the political organizing specifically that had emerged in Seattle really in the 1990s. And so I went back and did more interviews that were more extensively targeted at specifically at people who'd been engaged in various sites of organizing around homelessness.
Well, let's talk a bit about some of that political organizing, because I think the media, the impression that the mainstream media, of course, has presented about homeless people involved in the Occupy movement is that they're mentally ill, that they're a drain on the occupiers' political efforts, as well as their limited material donations, et cetera. But as you find in your work and as the testimonies reveal, that women have played an important role, or they've been very interested in organizing to bring about systemic change.
Yeah, I think that's true. And I also think that some of the women, you know, who do identify as having various forms of mental illness also draw a lot of insight from that experience and the fact that, you know, there's so little, you know, I mean, one of the kind of first casualties of, quote, you know, structural adjustment in the U.S. is, of course, mental health treatment. It's drug treatment. I mean, we're still willing to incarcerate nonviolent drug offenders, you know, at an extreme taxpayer expense. In Washington State, the expense of incarcerating somebody for a year is about $38,000 a year, which is almost enough for 4 years at the University of Washington. So, you know, one of the women that I interviewed that really had a huge impact on my thinking about homelessness and the enormous expense of the military-industrial prison complex in the U.S.
Well, what about some of the organizations in Seattle that grew up around that deliberate effort to acknowledge and change their situation?
Right, right. Well, Anitra Freeman, again, was one of the founding members, founding members of the editorial board at Real Change, which is the street newspaper in Seattle. And she was, you know, involved in multiple sites of political organizing and also one of the women most active with the Women's Housing Equality and Enhancement League in Seattle. And I did a number of interviews with women who are involved with that group, which is the acronym is WHEEL. And WHEEL has worked extensively with SHARE to coordinate the tent cities in Seattle, to coordinate a whole network of mostly church and synagogue-based shelters that are self-governing and that are one of the largest, if not the largest, provider of shelter in Seattle. And the other site or group that I worked with to document was the Seattle's Women in Black. So, you know, I think most of us are most familiar with the Women in Black movement and the vigils that are looking at, you know, violence in the context of war. But Seattle's Women in Black, which emerged in, I believe, the first vigils that they stood were in 2000. And it was at the turn of the millennium that they began standing to mark the deaths of people who had died homeless and, you know, on the streets of, you know, the city that spawned Starbucks, Microsoft, and, you know, is considered one of the most livable cities in the U.S. And I think one of the things that we often don't think about in connection with homelessness, or we don't think about it frequently enough, is the fact that people are dying homeless on the streets of the U.S. all the time. They're dying homeless on the streets of Portland. And some of that is through exposure, through illness. You know, in cold climates, we think about the possibility of exposure, but we don't frequently think about the fact that homelessness itself causes, you know, chronic forms of illness. It, you know, if you're homeless for a single night, you're at risk of raped, assaulted, murdered. You're at risk of dying by accident. Many homeless people also have committed suicide out of sheer despair for their condition. And I think it's kind of timely that we're talking about this at the beginning of December, because December 21st is National Homeless Persons Memorial Day, which is an event that's celebrated around the country to kind of call attention to the deaths of homeless people on the streets. And Portland, I understand, for the first time this winter, will be beginning to document the deaths of homeless people. And I think that's a really, really important development. For me, the work that I did, or the kind of participant observer research that I did with the homeless and formerly homeless activists in Women in Black Seattle, was incredibly eye-opening to me. I mean, one of the first vigils that I stood with them, actually I think it was the first vigil, was for a man by the name of Doug Dawson, who was a 51-year-old amputee who was lit on fire in his wheelchair while he was sleeping on the streets of Spokane. And when the firefighters arrived to put out the fire, they believed that they were putting out a quote-unquote trash fire. And I think, you know, to me, that death, which was so absolutely brutal, and which many of the women that I interviewed spoke about specifically, also spoke to me about the ways in which homeless people are kind of represented as a public sanitation problem, as if they're, you know, somehow not even human. And so Doug Dawson, you know, died from his injuries in Harborview Hospital in Seattle. And it was the organizing of Women in Black that really called attention to his death, I think, and sort of amplified its effect and catalyzed some reflection about the implications of that death. And I think there is a very direct relationship between the kind of hate crimes and violence that homeless people are subject to, which is, you know, very infrequently spoken about, if ever, in mainstream media. And, you know, there's been a really kind of startling rise of attacks on homeless people, which the National Coalition for the Homeless has documented in a report called Death, Hate, Violence on Main Street. So I kind of slightly butchered the title there. But it's exactly, I think, the kind of work that these homeless and formerly homeless women are doing in Seattle that makes that kind of suffering visible. And the next vigil that I stood with them was for a woman, Tanya Sunshine Smith, who was a 42-year-old African-American woman who was murdered. And a couple of days before she was murdered, she came into the Women's Empowerment Center in Seattle that WEAL also coordinates. And she wanted to know about the progress of the city's 10-year plan to end homelessness. And she was absolutely panicked that there was not a shelter bed available for her that night. And so to me, I mean, that's such an eye-opening question. You know, what's the progress of the 10-year plan to end homelessness when I have to find a place to sleep tonight? And that you know, I don't know how many nights she had spent homeless in that week or that month, but certainly, you know, within 2 days, she had been murdered and killed, and her body was discovered by, you know, the garbage collectors at dawn, and she had been, you know, repeatedly stabbed and dragged herself out of the place, you know, the bushes where she had spent the night. So many of the women that I interviewed spoke specifically to, you know, the brutality of Tanya's death and of Doug Dawson's death and what that said about the dehumanization of homeless people in the U.S. And I think we hear that dehumanization in the kind of rhetoric about the Occupy movement and the way in which the involvement of homeless people is being represented in it. And I mean, you know, I think most of us, hopefully many of us, understand that, you know, the experience of homeless people is, I mean, they are that 1% out of the 99 whose voices should be amplified. Their experience should be foregrounded by organizers in the Occupy movement, many of whom, thankfully, have now been in, you know, much more frequent dialogue to kind of learn in a far more immediate way what the struggles of homeless people are.
We just have a minute, Desiree, but tell us what some of the particular gender implications of homelessness and how homeless women face even greater challenges and demands on the streets.
Yeah, well, I think we frequently think about some kind of division between battered women and homeless women, and that really is a very artificial distinction. I mean, if you have not been battered by the time that you're homeless, you're far more likely, obviously, to be battered, raped, or murdered on the street in any given night that you spend homeless. And many, many women are forced to choose every day between the experience of being battered, raped, and or, you know, possibly murdered in their homes by an intimate partner, or, you know, do I choose that, or do I choose being battered, raped, and murdered by somebody, by a stranger on the street? So obviously, you know, homeless women are at far greater risk for sexual assault on the street, but it does also happen to homeless men.
This is Laurie Mercier for the Old Mole Variety Hour. We've been speaking today with Desiree Hellegers, author of a new book entitled No Room of Her Own, Women's Stories of Homelessness, Life, Death, and Resistance, published by Palgrave Press. And finally, Desiree, any suggestions to people, to listeners, about where they can go for more information in addition to your book, groups that they can find out about, such as WHEAL, other organizing efforts in the region and the country?
Right. Well, I mean, I think certainly we have a huge resource here, or a number of huge resources around homelessness in Street Roots, which I think is hands down the best alternative newspaper in this city. And also certainly Sisters of the Road. I mean, these folks have been doing this work in the trenches for a very long time. And also Dignity Village, right? I mean, we've had an amazing, you know, amazing kind of experience of organizing, homeless people organizing, and also you know, that now the right to survive. So we've got so much, you know, so much kind of activist knowledge by people who have experienced homelessness firsthand. And I think those are the, you know, voices that we really need to be pulling into these dialogues and debates with far greater frequency and great regularity.
Well, thanks so much for joining us today, Desiree Hellegers.